Hey everyone, welcome to Just Mental Health with Steph and Em, the podcast where we discuss mental health through a social justice lens. I'm Emily.
And I'm Stephanie. A quick disclaimer before we get started, we are mental health professionals, but this is not to be taken as professional advice.
We are also aware that our privilege may cloud our perspective on some topics, and we not only welcome, but encourage you to message us with criticism and correction. Let's get started. Our small business shout out is Plana Mind Center, a mental health service center in Northbrook, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. So they sent me some descriptions of their services. So I'm just going to read those. Let's see. So if you want to contact them, hannah.schindler@planamind.com. So H-A-N-N-A-H dot S-C-H-I-N-D-L-E-R at P-L-E-N-A-M-I-N-D.com. Aside from, so this is a note from Hannah. Aside from our founders and upper management being a strong team of bold and fearless women, here's some general program info that may be helpful. Our experienced clinical team is devoted to a renewed approach to modern medicine as we stay true to our mission of patient and family-centered treatment. The Plana team strives to understand and treat the whole child, taking into account the child's internal and external worlds. Plana's whole child approach ensures your child receives an initial assessment from a licensed clinician, a thorough evaluation from our board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist, and engages in an individualized, multidisciplinary treatment approach throughout the duration of the program. Small by design, our program allows for customized care for each child in a warm, welcoming environment. Partial hospitalization program. It is important to keep in mind that partial hospitalization program, PHP, is a short-term stabilization program. Plana's PHP is an evidence-based and multidisciplinary short-term stabilization program primarily, but not exclusively, rooted in CBT and DBT modalities. Participants primarily attend groups where they learn tools and skills to better understand and manage symptoms. Additionally, individual therapy and support sessions are intentionally infused into the program to augment group for programming and further personalize the experience for each participant. Intensive outpatient program, IOP. Plana's IOP provides customized outpatient treatment for children and adolescents who do not require the level of clinical hours necessary for PHP. The treatment framework is similar to PHP. However, IOP provides a unique structure that allows for full-time school exposure during the day, followed by therapeutic programming after school Monday and Monday through Thursday. So they are, like I said, they're in Northbrook, Illinois, and they have a Instagram page, just Plana Mind. And through there, you can see their website, which is planamind.com, and learn more. And now, a quick ad.
All right. So today we have a returning guest. She was with us before, and she's here to continue talking about neurodiversity and the autism spectrum. We have Jennifer Kendrick, LCSW, LMFT, back with us. Thank you for being here again today.
I'm so happy to see you all again.
Yes. Yes. So very brief recap. If you did not listen to the first part of this, you should.
But you should
go back and listen to it.
Yeah, pause this, go back. But if you don't have time for that right now, we talked about what neurodiversity was, a little bit about autism spectrum disorder, and then talked about how you can go about how it's typically done to get a diagnosis. And we talked about some of the implications with that and access to care and stuff like that. So today we're going to talk more about what happens after that diagnosis. What does that mean? What do you do? What does it look like getting treatment? And what are some of the issues that people that have that diagnosis face through that process? So I don't know where you want to start, Jennifer. I guess, you know, we could start with someone has received that diagnosis. They've already been to the psychologist and everything. And now maybe they're coming to a therapist to work on whatever it is that they want to work on. Mm-hmm. And so now what?
So yeah, that's a great question. I'm really excited to kind of talk about the now what. Part of it depends on what age the person is when they're diagnosed. And I want to back up for just a second and say that not everybody who is autistic feels like it's a diagnosis. Many self-advocates feel like it's just a different way of being, just like being deaf. You know, the deaf community is very strong, and deafness is not a deficit. It's just another way of being. So people who are autistic, some people will say that, you know, it's just a different way of functioning in the world, which, you know, I firmly believe if you can function, whatever you consider functioning as, your diagnosis doesn't necessarily matter. And it's possible that someone like that would come to therapy to work on other things. Like you might, as a professional, you might see them as part of couples therapy, or you might see their child with like a parenting relationship issue, but they're probably not going to come specifically for autism. And realistically, there's a lot of controversy in treatment and within the autism community about quote curing unquote autism. I personally, professionally, this is just my personal point of view. I don't feel like autism is a thing that can or should be cured. I think it's just a different way of being. Now, when we're talking about somebody who regularly, you know, self-injures, is a danger to themselves or others, that's a different thing. And I don't believe that it necessarily matters that their diagnosis specifically is autism. What matters is the behavior, and that the behavior is not serving them well in their day-to-day life. So the gold standard for autism treatment, and I use that term, you know, with a grain of salt and with all of that baggage attached to it, the gold standard for the last 150 years has been ABA, applied behavior analysis. And ABA is very controversial within the autism community. A lot of autistic advocates, self-advocates, say that ABA is equivalent to conversion therapy for people who are LGBTQ. That's not been my experience. Now, granted, I have not been the recipient of ABA, so I welcome conversations about that. I was trained in ABA. I'm not an ABA therapist. I make that very clear. Old style ABA uses aversives, which can be things like, you know, someone goes to put their hand in their pants and a rubber band gets snapped on their wrist. Things that are painful and often dehumanizing, those have all been disavowed by the governing body of board certified behavior analysts. Those are not considered ethical. However, you will see from time to time in the news that there are facilities that work with people with autism who still use aversives. There is the judge, I forget what the name is, the center in Connecticut that recently got taken to the Supreme Court of Connecticut because they were using shock treatment on people with autism. well, people with developmental disabilities in general.
That's like old school psych, you know, yeah. when I would like use shock therapy and lobotomies and like all the stuff that we've tried, the dark, dark history you've tried to get away from, and people are still doing
sure. that. And I think it's really important to remember that that is part of our history. Mm-hmm. I think social workers, we like to kind of consider ourselves like superheroes, but we're not. I mean, every superhero is a supervillain in someone else's world.
Mm-hmm. True, true.
I had to take a sip of my coffee. So I will say that that has all been disavowed by the governing boards of ABA. However, it's a hard history to get away from. Mm-hmm. It would be like going on a dating site and seeing reviews from everyone's ex-partners and being like, yeah, that's probably not the person for me. That might be a bad analogy, but so when I work with clients, I really take a holistic, collaborative approach. And being a collaborative feminist family therapist, I can't not. So I want to make it very clear when I work with either individuals, older folks who are diagnosed, or adults on the spectrum, that what we consider to be socially appropriate behavior is largely contextual. So what would be socially appropriate for a person who presents as male is different from what's appropriate socially for a person who presents as female. Also, race plays a factor in that. So unfortunately, my clients who are boys and men of color, we do have to be more careful in teaching them safety skills. And it breaks my heart that that's something that we have to do, but it is a realistic thing that happens.
Yeah. And we've seen that in the news where a young Black man that had autism was targeted and attacked and killed by the police. And so, yeah, it, because this is so many reasons, but also this, the lack of awareness of what autism can look like and what it means. And he wasn't even doing anything dangerous, you know, to begin with, but.
There are cases every year, and there's a website that that keeps track of all of those things, that people of color with disabilities make up the vast majority of people with disabilities who are murdered by police. People with disabilities who inhabit marginalized identities are much more likely to have violent encounters with police that end in their deaths than they are to be a danger to anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that makes me really angry, well, so many things make me angry about mass shootings and things like that. The narrative seems to have shifted in the past maybe 5 years to, oh, well, that person was mentally ill and that's why they did that. That's probably true because many, many people live with undiagnosed mental health issues. But it does, I feel like in the social narrative that somehow gets interpreted as people with mental illness are dangerous. And that's just not the case. I mean, you all know this, and probably the people listening to this podcast know that as well, but I feel like it warrants saying.
Yeah, we did an episode on that actually, like 6 months ago or something. How do you go about treating people of color then?
A lot of collaboration with them and their families. Mm-hmm. I will never again write a crisis plan that involves calling the police, particularly for a person of color. And that's not an ACAB comment, but it's a realistic, I don't want to set anything in place that's going to put people at further risk. So some of that is collaborating with the community. So I have taken, I've gone with clients and their families to their nearest police station and fire station to talk to the people who work there so that they know this person, especially with a client who has a history of eloping or bolting. So if you see this person out on their own and you don't see any caregivers nearby, this is what needs to happen. Because it is different. And the Autism Society of America, which is the good one, that involves a lot of autistic self-advocacy, they have a safety plan on their website that includes like a identification card that you can give to first responders. So it has a picture of the individual, their name, their likes and dislikes, and what to do if you see them.
What was the name of that again?
The Autism Society. I believe it's autismsociety.org.
I think that would be a good resource to post. So I'm taking notes for that. Because that's an awesome idea, a safety plan card. Yeah, which is unfortunate, but you know, you think, well, people with like diabetes and seizure disorders have medical alert bracelets, you know, or if you have a severe allergy to something, they sort of have that. So first responders know. I guess we got to do that with mental health too, because not everyone is aware or understands mental health issues or just neurodiversity, which is not necessarily a mental health issue. It's just a different way of being.
So I always take a collaborative approach. I don't know if it's because I was trained as a marriage and family therapist or if it's just kind of the way that I think, but people live in communities and have relationships to those communities, both small and large. So one of my favorite things about doing this work is that I get to collaborate with a lot of other professionals. 60% of people with an autism diagnosis also have a seizure disorder. So I collaborate a lot with neurologists because they love professionals, especially professionals who can provide additional information and take data. I love data. It's part of why I love research. But, you know, I've had several clients over the years who've had seizure disorders. And it's been interesting because I had one who really didn't have any challenging behaviors, except for, we figured out from looking at the data, right before she had a seizure. And it was like her brain just went, blah! And we'd have all kinds of issues. And then within 24 hours, she'd have a seizure. So using that data, the family and I went to the neurologist and got a preventative medication just for that. So that when the behavior increased, they knew to provide the medication and it stopped the seizures from happening. And these were really bal. They were grand mal seizures that only stopped with medication. So it was able to kind of shift that into a preventative approach. And when she didn't have seizures, she didn't have a loss of language or learning. Everything just got a whole lot better. And it was just that simple, like recognizing the pattern that was really amazing.
Yeah, that is incredible. I've seen that too. I've worked as a in-home caregiver before I was in social work with adults with disabilities. And there was a lot of people with seizure disorders. So there was a lot of training around that. And so I spent a lot of nights sitting up with people that were having seizure after seizure after seizure. But I would notice the behavior change that would come right before it. It was like, I was like, at first I was like, you're not like this. You never do this. What are you doing? And then a seizure would happen. And I was like, oh, it's so interesting how it really changes a person's, personality or perception right before and right after too. I mean, there were personality changes immediately following that that took hours to go away. So
yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things that I think unless you work with the with that particular community, maybe you don't necessarily know or have experience with. So in addition to working with medical providers like neurologists and pediatricians and psychiatrists, I guess this is the opportunity to say there are no medications that treat autism.
Mm-hmm.
You can't cure it with a magic pill. It is probably a multi-gene factor that causes autism. This is also my opportunity to use my soapbox to say vaccines don't cause autism. Even if they did, it's better to have a child who is autistic than it is to have a child who is dead from a preventable illness. Exactly. That is a hill I am willing to die on.
Mm-hmm.
Come at me.
And that just shows like the amount of like hate for people with autism, like the fact that people would rather have their kids have this deadly illness than autism.
Yep.
It just shows a stigma. But anyway,
I firmly agree. Yes. Yeah. So in addition to working with medical providers, I also get to work with occupational therapists and speech therapists and physical therapists. And I didn't have a whole lot of experience with occupational therapists before I became a therapist who works with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I thought they were just like, if you got injured at work, you know, you had to like rehab your hand or wrist or something. So you went to see an occupational therapist. But really, they work with all kinds of skills across the board. So skills of daily living, whether it's like, you know, making food or brushing your teeth or taking a shower, all the way to, you know, like functional professional skills, like, you know, fine tuning your finger and muscle dexterity so that you can do like particular machining work if that's what you're trained to do. So I've had experiences with a lot of good OTs. I've had some not great experience with OTs. I would say some of the most useful stuff that I have learned from OTs is about sensory diets. So if someone, it's not at all uncommon, and this is still not a diagnosing factor in autism, but it's not at all unusual for somebody to be hypo or hyper responsive to stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
So hypo responsive would be the people who seek out things to activate their senses. These are kids who like smell things and put stuff in their mouths and touch everything and maybe like crash into things. They are the deep pressure people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They just need that to kind of regulate their nervous systems.
They like the weighted blankets.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And the squeeze. Then on the other side of things are the hyper responsive people. These are people who are very sensory avoidant. So bright lights, loud noises, all of these things may trigger some challenging behaviors because their nervous system is just saying, nope, too much, can't do it. And it's not unusual for people to be both hypo and hyper aroused by different things. Mm-hmm. So somebody might be hypo aroused and need a lot of physical input, but be really averse to loud noises or strong smells, or, you know, vice versa. So it's hard to kind of figure those things out. But working with occupational therapists, I've learned that if you have like a baseline OT diet, so something like a regular routine where people are getting activated in a really controlled sort of way. So early on, there's early on in OT, often people do brushing and there's a method. It sort of looks like a very soft vegetable brush or like a baby's hairbrush. And there is a evidence-based method for the number of times and where and how you brush the skin that's supposed to kind of calm the overall central nervous system. And I've seen it work, and it's cool. It's time consuming because parents typically have to do it multiple times a day at the beginning. And it's an unusual thing. So sometimes kids at first don't particularly care for it or don't want to sit still for it. But after a while, it becomes enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, I like that. Like, just the idea of working in those sensory things, like maybe it is sleeping with a weighted blanket, or when you're watching TV, having that weighted blanket on you, or yeah, having like fidget stuff and, you know, sensory rooms or, you know, something that a swing or something, you know, that someone can use when needed, and kind of working that in to their everyday to manage it so that it doesn't become this like, wow, I've been going on for so long without these needs. Now I'm going to try and fulfill that, mm-hmm. you know, right now in a place that's probably not safe or appropriate.
Right. Or in a way that people understand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of my clients who is very much a deep pressure seeker would go up to people and it kind of looked like he would headbutt them.
Uh-huh.
But what he wanted was that pressure on the top of his head. So really what we did was we taught him to ask. So he would now, his aide will, he'll like come in front of his aide, like stand in front of him and just say, push, please. And his aide will put his hands on top of the kid's head and just kind of like gently rest them and kind of push down. And that helps, and it meets that need in a way that is slightly more socially appropriate.
Yeah.
It's still odd. I mean,
it's an odd behavior. Someone that didn't know was walking by and saw that, they'd be like, what are you doing to that child?
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely a better way.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Like, I mean, just from my understanding of what you're sharing about like changes in treatment approaches, like probably like years ago, it would be like, you can't do like, you, we need to get you to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's like, okay, like if this is what you need and this is what like calms you or what your body's telling you it needs, that's okay. You just have to do it with people's permission, or you have to do it in this like more socially acceptable manner.
Right. Because yeah. People will get that need met in any way they can.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a pretty vocal opponent of restraint, because I've seen one of three things happen when someone is restrained. Either it meets that need, so they're going to keep doing whatever it took to get that need met,
mm-hmm.
or it overstimulates them so much that as soon as they get free, they're going to clock you. And I objectively feel like this is the worst one. It breaks their spirits. It just basically shows them that because someone is bigger than you, you can be forced into compliance. And that's not something that we ever want to teach purposefully or accidentally. I'm very clear that I don't teach compliance, because people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are much more likely to be victims of physical and sexual abuse than typically developing children. And girls and women are much more likely to be sexually abused if they have an intellectual or developmental disability. Some of that is related to dependence. So if you're reliant on the care of others, the probability increases. Some of it is related to how we construct people with disabilities, of not having their own agency. So that kind of goes both ways. And before we started recording, this is something that I was talking about, because I'm working on an article right now about sex and relationship education for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And there's kind of two extremes. Either caregivers believe that people are just at risk and they construct everything, all of the educational materials, everything through that lens of risk reduction, taking away any like agency, or you can have a choice to be in a relationship with someone, or hang on just a second.
Oh, yeah, no, I think that's really important, because not only do you take, when you're only focusing on the risk, and not the agency or the consent, you're also not talking about pleasure at all. Right. And people with disabilities are just as much entitled to having pleasurable intimate experiences as anyone else. So, I mean, that's a lot of the reason why people do it anyways. So you want to, how can you have pleasure, and what is that for you? What do you like? What do you not like? How can you communicate that? All that needs to be part of the education.
Right. And that was, sorry, I had to mute my microphone for a little bit because my coffee grinder just started up because it's haunted. So part of the other extreme is looking at people with intellectual and developmental disabilities as like almost like the insatiable sexual monster. So we think about like Lenny from Of Mice and Men and Frankenstein's monster, and just like people who are so needy and have no impulse control, and they're a danger to other people, which is so bizarre to me. Because if you're not providing people with any of the appropriate education, if you're constructing them in the binaries of innocent, delicate flower or perpetuary, that's not a word.
Raging hormone monster.
Right, raging hormone monster. There's a whole lot in between that we're not accounting for.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times, no, I know from the research, a lot of times people are labeled as having problematic sexual behavior just because of the context where they live. So if you live in a group home and you don't have the opportunity to have private time and you want to masturbate, where are you going to do it? In common areas.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how that works. People need private time,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, you know, to take care of sexual needs or if it's just to get a break from people. A lot of times with that idea of like the delicate flower, it takes away any possibility of consensual positive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is sad, because I think everybody has the right to a relationship if they want one. So it's something that I'm working on as part of my kind of larger research project of developing relationship education curricula for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Because even the research is kind of biased, because they're interviewing parents and caregivers rather than the individuals themselves, when to some extent that's understandable because of different communication abilities. But then also, like, the data that I have access to right now, which is from a statewide survey, there were 141 people interviewed, and there are 11 of them who reported their sexual orientation. 10 were heterosexual, 1 was lesbian. That's not very good return on
Mm-mm.
on questionnaires.
It's also not believable, because there's no way
right
those were the only people that had any sexual orientation
right. So that also calls into question the other part of the questionnaire, which is about gender identity. and makes me think that all of those answers, because there's much closer to 141, there were still a few people who skipped that question because these questions were administered by caregivers.
You're not going to want to talk to your mom all the time about, I didn't
know somebody in a staffed residence and you know, they're coming in with their own baggage and preconceived notions about what people with intellectual and developmental disabilities can and should do. That makes me think that that gender identity question was just, it was answered from like a visual, like you present as female, you must be female. So getting an actual, like a grounded theory with participatory research is really, really important to me because, you know, the whole thing with the disability rights movement has always been nothing about us without us. And it's all of this research has been happening without people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Nothing about us without us. I like that.
Yeah. That's I think that started in the early 90s. And part of it is local history, because some of the early advocacy was related to public transportation accessibility for people who were wheelchair users. And in Louisville, they did a sit-in and a lie-in at TARC to increase accessibility. So yeah, yay for rabble rousers.
Yeah.
Good trouble, right? In the true John Lewis sense. So in addition to the occupational therapy, speech therapy is really helpful for people who have problems either with articulation or with coming up with words. Because if you think about going through your entire day without being able to communicate your needs and wants, how likely are any of us to make it through the end of the day without throwing something? I might make it through a whole day. I don't think I could do two. And that's like if you have no verbal ability whatsoever. So usually communication ability is really closely tied to behavior, because if I can't tell you what I want, I'm going to get my needs met some way. So I'm either going to try to get it myself, or I'm going to drag you to the thing to get it for me, or I'm just going to scream at you until you figure out what it is that I want. So communication is super important. And then physical therapy, you know, a lot of people with autism have some significant sensory needs and difficulties that can affect the way that their muscles and their central nervous system work. So working on increasing that, low muscle tone is super common with people on the spectrum, which, you know, causes everything from, you know, not being able to sit up at a desk. So when you ask a kid, okay, come in, sit at your desk, and they have low muscle tone, it's really exhausting to sit at a desk all the time. So these are the kids who like flop around and they're, you know, on the floor, like face first on the desk. And it may just be a pure like core strength kind of thing that needs to be worked on. So alternative seating works really well for these kids. You know, if you're still doing your work and you want to sit in the beanbag chair, okay, cool. If you want to sit on the bouncy ball or on the floor, you know, I think schools and teachers are getting a lot better about being appropriately flexible in those areas. There are still some that, you know, are adamant that things should be done a certain way. But this is kind of the overlap between working with children with intellectual and developmental disabilities and working with people in general. You have to pick your battles. Is it more important for you for the kid to sit in a chair, or is it more important for them to get their work done?
Right. Well, that kind of goes back to the compliance thing. Is your concern their ability to learn and complete the work, or is your concern their compliance with what you want? Because those are different things. And yeah, if the kid's doing the work and not disturbing other children from doing their work. What is, you know, what's the issue? I've seen those. I saw this article about them, and I don't know if they were actually a thing or if they were actually helpful, but it was like these seat cushion things that you could put on chairs, but they had like little balls. It almost looked like a medieval torture device, except like you're supposed to sit on it and the balls put in the pressure, and it was supposed to help kids with that were sensory seeking. And I guess even with like ADHD, to remain in their seat longer because of that sensation and that pressure. And I was like, that's really interesting. And I kind of looked like it would feel good actually.
I mean, I have provided a lot of adaptations for clients to have at their desks. So sometimes it's just one of my clients at his desk, we had a strip up at the top that had his break card attached for it and a help card. Even though he was verbal, he needed reminders that, oh, I can ask for a break. I can ask for help. I don't need to scream at somebody or like rip my work up or throw things in order to get my needs met. And then I also put at the top of his desk, I think it's Seneca, who like going way back to quoting Latin, because, you know, why not? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Because he would hyper focus on this has to be just right. Mm-hmm. And it would kind of create this inability to move on. And, you know, I probably need one of those at my desk. Mm-hmm. I have visual reminders. How many of us have post-its on our desk, you know, on our computer monitors about like when things are due, or just reminders of, you know, I've heard a lot of like organizational health experts recommend putting it like a post-it that's just like every 15 minutes, get up and stretch.
Right.
Because we need those things.
Well, that's a good point. Like how many people without disabilities or neurotypical people use visual auditory reminders for things, prompts all the time. And it's not considered strange or different, or, you know, as like, oh, you need extra assistance for your disability. Like, I mean, we set alarms to remind us for things. I put in everything on my phone so that I not only will remember, but also I keep like a whole bunch of notes with different lists of things, like, because I need that I can check it and be like, okay, yeah, this is what I need at the grocery store. This is what I need to do. And sometimes this is what I need to do in a certain order, so I don't get distracted, you know, doing something else. And that's all very like common for people. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that, you know, they would need that in school. I think more kids probably need those adaptations than just those with disabilities or in special classes, because
skills that people, like in general, those are just like executive functioning skills that everyone should be taught.
And that's the thing, that is what I am basically trying to prove with my research about relationship education. When you start from a point of accessibility, it's then accessible to everyone.
Right.
Instead of starting with, okay, this curriculum has been researched and is appropriate for white middle-class heterosexual couples. If you start in the most general way possible, it's going to encompass everyone. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember if I talked about this last time, but there's a method called TEACH, T-E-A-C-C-H, and it's about classroom management with, it was made for people with autism, for autism-specific classrooms. But when you look at a TEACH classroom, and I just recommend Googling it, it is a classroom that's really set up for every learner. So there's visual schedules, so everybody knows what it is that they're doing that day. Kids have individual clipboards if they go to different things. So if you go to one classroom for reading, you'll have like a picture and the text, you know, go to Mrs. Smith's class for reading. And then the classroom itself, everything is set up kind of in centers. I don't know if you all had centers in your elementary school classrooms, but I did. I'm in a Montessori school for kindergarten, so I love the centers, but they're very clearly divided so that you know what work you're doing where. And everything is put up, everything is labeled, so it's not an overwhelming classroom. It's not cluttered with stuff. When I go into classrooms that are cluttered with stuff, immediately, maybe it's because I've had these experiences, I see those as the opportunity for projectiles.
Oh, so yeah.
If somebody starts to lose it, what's going to go on the floor or in the air immediately?
What's going to be thrown at
box
you?
Of crayons.
Yeah.
So having those, I mean, even in my office, everything is in a clear plastic tote. It's all labeled. You can see exactly what's in there, but it's put up so that it's not overwhelming. And that also really works with kids who've experienced trauma or kids who have a lot of anxiety, because it turns their environment into something that is safe and predictable and accessible. And it helps grownups too.
Yeah. I mean, I can see so many benefits for a system like that, because it also encourages some like responsibility and like, okay, I know what, if I go to this section, I'm supposed to do this. I go to this section, I'm supposed to do this. And the teacher's not having to prompt you every time, maybe, you know, because that's the routine, you know, what is expected in each section, everything's labeled. So if the teacher's like, get the crayons, the kids know where the crayons are and they know what you're talking about. So it kind of a self-paced and self-learning as well system. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah. So I've spent a lot of time talking about kids. I should probably talk about grownups for a little bit.
Yes, sure.
I'm somewhat biased. I love children. I think they're the best way to start people.
Right.
So with adults, when adults with autism come in, whether they're diagnosed as children or diagnosed later in life, a lot of the work that I do with them is about skill acquisition. And that kind of ties into what we've already been talking about, because there are skills that everybody needs to have. But when you have a neurodiversity experience, you may just need to learn those more explicitly. So I've had clients come in because they really struggle with time management, which is an executive functioning skill. So we work on, okay, well, what does help you? Setting timers, do you need an accountability partner? I learned about ADHD body doubling from TikTok because, you know, why not? It was a professional.
Oh yeah, I saw that on TikTok.
What? I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay. So body doubling is, Emily, do you want to explain it?
Well, it's when you're like doing a task, but you just have someone there. Is that just like a moral support sort of? Yeah. Like if you have to like clean your house, but you just like can't get yourself to do it because
Emily and I would do that all the time when we lived in the city.
No, I was like scrolling through TikTok and I was like, I do this. I didn't even have had a name, but like having someone just there, like it, even if they're not like do your cleaning, you know, it still just like gives you some sense of accountability and like gets you to focus better.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Cool.
And people do it all the time. People write their dissertations in libraries with someone else just sitting across from them. They're not talking. They're not working on the same thing.
That's how we got through grad school. We would all write our papers, different papers, in the same group in the library together in solidarity, staying up all night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like it just helped. Yeah.
You do what helps.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that is what I do with adults. We look at what are you doing that's already working? Can we do more of that? Or do we need to adapt it in some way? A lot of it is also teaching the relationship skills that, believe it or not, no one is just born knowing
right.
how to communicate their feelings to other people. And some of us have great emotional experiences growing up where, you know, our caregivers are responsive to our emotional needs and provide us with the vocabulary that we need to express our emotional needs. And many people do not grow up with that experience. So when you are on the spectrum, you know, one of the diagnostic criteria is kind of not being able to pick up on those social cues and learning from your environment. So you just need to learn it more explicitly. So with autism, one of the deficits that is pretty common is called theory of mind. And I don't remember if I talked about theory of mind last time. So theory of mind is basically the understanding that my ideas are different than your ideas. And this is something that develops over time. When we're children, we think that when we're very small children, we think that our caregivers feel the same way that we do. So if I'm hungry, mom must be hungry too, which like biologically makes sense, right? Because if you have received your nutrition from your mother mm-hmm. for the first 9 months of your, you know, while yeah. you're in utero, and then, you know, for the first however long of your existence, it makes sense that you see your mother as an extension of you. But as we age, we start to realize that our parents are autonomous people. Hopefully we start to realize that. And we start to realize that, oh, other people think differently than I do. The difference is when you have an autism diagnosis is you may not realize that. That may not
be something. What is this called again?
It's called theory of mind.
Theory of mind. Okay.
Yeah. So there's an old, old autism test called the Sally Ann problem. So Sally and Ann are standing together. Sally has a ball. She puts the ball in the box. Where is Ann going to look for the ball? In the box. She knows that Sally put the ball in the box. Now, if Ann leaves the room and Sally puts the ball behind the couch, when she comes back, where's Anne going to look for the ball?
In the box.
In the box, because that's where it was before. People with autism will often say behind the couch because Anne somehow knows that the ball is now behind the couch. That's theory of mind. And you can imagine with couples with mixed neurology, how challenging that would be to be in a couple relationship. So if I think that you should just know what it is that I'm feeling or what I mean or what I'm, you know, saying without saying it, it's basically a minefield.
Okay, but yes, and to be fair, that sometimes just happens in neurotypical relationships right. too. You right. want the other person to mind read and that doesn't work out. So, but yeah.
It is. And I, you know, often tell couples that if you're going to assume things, why not assume the best of intentions?
Yeah. Because
that will probably make you less miserable.
Yeah.
But sometimes I have to explicitly tell the neurodivergent partner in a mixed neurology couple, your partner does not know that that's what you mean. Your partner, unless you have like a shared calendar, it would be expected that your partner would be upset if you were 2 hours late coming home. Well, it was in the calendar. They knew that I was working late. Did they though? If you did not tell them that you were working late, if you don't have a shared calendar, they're not going to know that. So you can get mad that they're upset with you about that. But what purpose does that serve? Mm-hmm. What is your end goal here? So, and that's like one of the possible solutions is share a calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So they might think that if it's on their calendar that like they don't see yeah. that their partner doesn't see their yeah. calendar, that their right. partner is different. Okay.
I right.
see.
Or if, even if it's not a calendar, if they're just like, well, I'm working late tonight, and they don't say that to their partner, they may just think their partner knows that.
Okay.
It's that theory of mind deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you see it with when people get upset about things and their partner doesn't understand why they're upset. And they say things like, well, you shouldn't be upset. Well, that's not terribly helpful. And often that escalates the argument. I don't know if you all have had that experience. I have.
Never.
Not once.
Right. Isn't that what they say? Like, never in the history of telling someone to calm down have they calmed down. Like,
I say that all the time. Yes. Yeah.
No, doesn't work.
Not a good thing. So, you know, sometimes saying that, like, you know, in these situations, kind of giving people a script helps a lot. And it helps with neurotypical people too,
because yeah.
I will sometimes tell my husband, like, your line here is, oh, that sucks. Or like prefacing it with, well, what I need you to do is just hold space. I don't need you to problem solve here.
That's what I'll tell. Yeah, I do that with clients too, neurotypical couples, of like, well, have you told your partner what you want them to do when you're sad? Because they don't know. You know, they might do what they would want when they're sad, which is not the same thing that you want. I'm like, tell them, especially if you are a woman in a relationship with a man, you do have to sort of explicitly line that out. And there's nothing wrong with that, because he wants a problem solved typically. So tell him exactly what he needs to do, you know? And so if you have someone that is more of this, like, I need to do something when my partner is upset, tell them what it is you want. Maybe that do something is leave you the hell alone. Or maybe it's, I want a hug, or I want you to sit there and hold me when I cry, or I want you to try to make jokes, you know, but not going to be appropriate for every person and situation. So I've used that a lot. Okay. That's so interesting.
That is theory of mind right there. People, I think sometimes when people are diagnosed later in life, they worry that this means something, like, this means that I'm not capable of improving my relationships, or it means that I'll never be in a relationship. And, you know, the data just does not bear that out. People have the capacity to change their behavior and improve throughout their lifespan. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this work, right? Like, there's a reason that we all do this, because we believe that people can change and we can hold hope for people. So I think at the end of the day, when someone receives a diagnosis, or when your child or someone you care about receives a diagnosis of an intellectual or developmental disability, I would love if people were provided with all of these resources, and also understood that this doesn't really change who they are as a person, and it doesn't change their limitless possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. I, looking at it from, you know, the perspective of, it's not, the goal is not to change you. The goal is to help you live the life that you want to live. And that's the way it is. That's the way it is for, you're working with neurotypical people. It's not, I'm not trying to change who you are, but if you're saying that this particular part of you or this particular thing is getting in the way of what you want, then we need to figure out what we can do. But it's not for me to sit there and say, well, you need to be more empathetic. Like, that's not what I didn't come here for that. You know, like,
If the behavior is not serving you, what would you like to do to change it?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes part of our job as therapists is to make suggestions about, okay, so you say you want to change this, but you don't know what you would like to change. Have you thought about what your life would look like if this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And giving them that agency, like, giving them the agency, like, do you want to change this? Have you thought about what your life would look like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've often said that my therapist, CNC, you all remember CNC, right? Mm-hmm. The child's toy that you pull the string and it repeats the thing, like the cow says moo. If I had a therapist, CNC, it would be, have you talked to your partner about this?
Yes.
What would you like to do about that? How is that working for you? Is this behavior still serving you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I could just have that, I probably would be able to be out of a job. Just pull those, push those buttons and, you know.
I've had clients say, this was happening and then I heard your voice and you said this and I'm like, oh no, is that my catchphrase? Like, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that how you're going to remember me? Okay. Yeah.
I kind of love that though.
I think we're running towards the end of time. Running towards the end of time. Running out of time.
That sounds like an epic song title for like a rock ballad. Running towards the end of time.
We're running towards the end of time. But no, I really, you know, I did a lot of listening today because I don't know a ton about this. But I feel like I learned a lot from you. Just like the general, like advocating and like changing the way society sees people with autism and, you know, neurodiversity, like it's so important. And it's so like, there's just so many misconceptions. And also like the, you know, the piece that you talked about with like clients of color, like that's such an important thing that no one talks about. And like the, you know, the, how like people with autism are like sexual beings, just like everyone else. Like there's so many pieces that people just don't talk about and don't know. And I really appreciate the work you do and that you, came on our podcast to share it with us and all of our listeners.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, this is something that I'm obviously really passionate about and, you know, not where I thought my career would go when I finished graduate school, but, you know, I've worked with other populations and like, these are my people. Mm-hmm. I really like doing this. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope that I'll be back on again and we can talk about precious child syndrome and what I call precious child syndrome and infertility.
Yeah. And Jennifer will be on again. So be looking for that episode in the future. Especially
Jennifer,
if you like,
knows a lot about a lot of things.
Yeah.
I could be like, there's so many things we could have you on here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We could talk about that. Yeah. Yeah. I am a person you want on your trivia team, unless it's about like sports trivia. And then like, I can give you hockey trivia and like maybe football, not American football, like real football.
Yeah.
Trivia about that, but very limited.
That's more than I could do. So, all right. Well, thank you again.
That's our show. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, follow, and share.
And don't forget to follow the show's Instagram for updates on new episodes at Just Mental Health Podcast. It's with a period between each word. This is Steph.
And M.
And Jennifer.
Signing off. Thanks for listening.